Welcome to Ipsos Politics Talk. My name is Kieran Pedley, and on this week's episode, we're going to be looking back at the year that was 2022, the craziest year in Westminster and beyond since the last one, I think. Plenty has happened, and to go over some of that, I'm joined by my colleague in Ipsos Manchester, Holly Day. Holly, welcome.
Hi, Kieran.
We're very pleased to be joined by Deputy Political Editor of the Evening Standard, our sort of esteemed partners on the monthly Ipsos Political Monitor, David Bond. David, welcome.
Thanks, Kieran. Nice to be here.
I'll spare everyone the Christmas jumpers that I've been trialing in the last sort of couple of weeks, but for those that follow me, we'll maybe see if we can get a picture up of that later, of my Liz Truss Christmas jumper, but I'll leave that to the imagination of the people for the time being. God, where do we start looking back at this year? I mean, David, I'll come to you. We started the year with the pandemic was the number one issue on voters' minds. Boris Johnson was prime minister, behind in the polls, granted. And there was still a sense of, well, you know, maybe Boris goes on to win re-election whenever that election might be. How times have changed. I mean, what have you made of it all?
Well, it's obviously been, I mean, these words have been so overused. I mean, they've become almost meaningless to try and describe and capture the extraordinary events at Westminster over the past 12 months. As you say, you started the year, and if you go back to the numbers, you know, here is a Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who had still, you know, had an 80-seat majority, should have been in his pomp. You know, he shouldn't have been facing the difficulties and problems that he came to face later in the year, but just head spinning in terms of the things that have happened, the number of big moments that, you know, I've been reporting out of Westminster for sort of 15 months now with the Standard, and people are saying to me, well, you've seen more happen in that time than people have in 15 years. And I know it's been a tumultuous period anyway before then, what with Brexit and everything else going on, but I think it has been, it goes without saying, truly extraordinary.
Yeah, we'll get on to obviously Liz Truss and where the Tories stand now, but a couple of moments on Boris Johnson, I guess. I mean, I was looking at some of the numbers earlier, and particularly in a year like this, it's always good to go back and sort of remind yourself of where we are, where we were. Johnson left office 69% dissatisfied with the job he was doing as Prime Minister, and whilst he did have his positives with the public, 8 in 10 thought he did a good job with the vaccine rollout. Majorities thought he did a good job on COVID and on Ukraine. And again, before people get angry with us, this is what the public say. You know, this isn't about us giving our opinion. This is what the public opinion was. But three quarters thought he did his government did a bad job on the cost of living. 7 in 10 thought he did a bad job on immigration and improving the NHS. And 52% said when he left office, the Conservatives don't deserve to be re-elected. And I know we'll come on to what's gone on since then. But where did it all go wrong for Boris Johnson, David? Because despite where the Conservatives are now, and some people would say, oh, they'd have been better off if they kept him, some people think not, but they weren't in a good spot when he left. We have to remember that, don't we?
No, that's right. And obviously, with all the problems that have unfolded since, they were all coming down the track, the cost of living crisis worsening, you know, the economy heading into recession and so on and so forth. But I mean, just to go back over exactly what happened. So he was forced out in July. You remember now, I mean, it all seems so much has changed since then. It's just worth reminding ourselves just exactly what it was. More than 50 ministers quitting. He'd lost confidence of the Tory party. This had all obviously been building for months and months. So if you go back to this time last year, it was when the Partygate story really was in full swing. And that kind of had set the course for him. But then there were all these other pressure points as well around his flat, around general conduct, the Owen Paterson sleaze storm. And then the sort of cherry on the sleazy cake was this whole business around Chris Pincher, the deputy chief whip, who was accused of groping. And, you know, at first Boris Johnson tried to sort of ride it out, and then eventually it was again, you know, his story or his sort of knowledge and the way he handled it rather than the actual incident itself that I think just made so many Conservative MPs who were already sort of pretty frustrated with him, because it was a sense that sort of number 10 wasn't functioning properly, that he wasn't listening to backbenchers, that this just became, you know, too much for him to carry on. And so you had this complete collapse in confidence in him. even though, as you say, you know, 80 seat majority, but he just sort of lost support on both the right and the center of his party. And as he said at the time, them's the breaks.
Mm. Holly, I'll bring you in here. I mean, obviously, there's a number of different explanations for where it went wrong for Boris Johnson. I mean, I've got to stop calling him Boris. It's one of those verbal tics you have, isn't it? Like, we all do it. It's just, I don't know what it is. And I've seen the same with Rishi now. You see that a lot in the press too. Anyway, naughty Kieran. But where do you stand on, what do you think did for Boris Johnson? Was it Partygate? Was it other issues? I mean, I guess maybe it's a conference of everything, but it felt like Partygate just sort of rumbled on and on and on. But then Boris Johnson is one of those great survivors. It was personally sort of struggle to believe he goes until he does. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think it did look like that for a while. I mean, Partygate rumbled on for probably about 6 months, and ultimately wasn't really the thing that brought him down. It was a culmination, as David said, of all of the additional things on top of that. And really, I think it came down to trust. I think we were polling 6 in 10 towards the end, didn't have trust in him. And quite crucially, among 2019 Conservative voters, the numbers started to really get bad for the Conservatives there. And I think that was the moment that led to the resignations and the number of resignations that came in so quickly. And I think he just realised at that point he probably couldn't carry on without the support of the party behind him. But up until those resignations, I think despite all of the accusations that were thrown at him, the different things that were rumbling on in the background, he probably could still have carried on if that kind of waterfall of resignations hadn't come at the time that it did.
Yeah, if I could just jump back in there quickly. Of course, the thing that is still coming down the track is the Privileges Committee investigation into Boris Johnson. And, you know, obviously a lot of Conservative MPs, a lot of his fellow ministers knew that was coming as well. And this whole question of trust, as Holly rightly says, is key to this. And this would have got to the heart of that, because did he mislead the House over what he knew about parties? That really was fundamental, and that was really, I guess, that was his downfall.
And before we move on from Boris Johnson, I mean, David, how much do you think by-elections and the polls and just the local elections and things of that nature mattered in terms of where Conservative MPs ended up? Because I'm struck by, it felt like in Boris Johnson's career, certainly as an MP, there were a fair few Tory MPs didn't particularly want him, did they? I mean, it was this kind of unholy alliance is probably a bit loaded.
It was.
But, you know, the sense of, well, he's a winner and you bring him in and we're not quite sure about it, but okay, he gets a job done sort of thing. Whereas once that stopped being the case, as maybe you could argue we saw before Rishi Sunak took over, there wasn't a huge Boris Johnson base in the Conservative Party, was there? So do you think those actual election results, which started to challenge the notion that he was a winner and all the rest of it, might have hurt him too? Because we haven't talked much about the actual votes themselves, have we?
No, I think that's right. I think there were already big jitters. I remember writing around this time last year, for the start of January, some predictions from Lord Hayward, the Tory peer and pollster, about how bad it was looking for the Tories in terms of those local elections in May. And he sort of said, you know, Wandsworth and Westminster, you know, these two iconic London boroughs could fall, that had been Conservative for years and years and years, and they could fall to Labour. And of course, that's exactly what happened. Now, if you look at the overall picture on the night of the May elections, actually, the Tories made some interesting gains in places. It wasn't completely one-sided. It wasn't about a Labour complete landslide in those local elections. But I think there were just one or two totemic ones, particularly in the capital around those Tory seats. Or Tory councils, that really, I think, you know, sort of again justified those who already didn't like Boris Johnson to question whether he was this invincible election winner. And then the by-elections you mentioned, I'm trying to remember them now. What was it? Chesham and Amersham, which Lib Dems won. Then you've got the one in Devon as well.
Tiverton,
exactly, yeah. Which went to the Conservatives. Went against the Conservatives to the Lib Dems. So, you know, I think again those would have made Tory backbenchers who were already unhappy with Johnson even more jittery.
Let's talk about Liz Truss for 5 minutes or so, which is about as long as she was Prime Minister. But I mean, I was looking back at the numbers because I was at Labour conference this year, sort of presenting some of our sort of Ipsos polling, and going back to that presentation, so this was before the mini budget, I was struck by actually what a reasonably positive position she entered office in. So to put numbers to that, in September, the Conservatives were 10 points behind Labour, the Tories were on 30 and Labour on 40. It's obviously a deficit, but certainly nothing you think would be insurmountable mid-Parliament with two or so years to go. And on Liz Truss herself, her first leader satisfaction rating was 44% don't know. And I remember very distinctly saying, having a chart up saying, the jury's out on Liz Truss. Because it might be hard for politicos to know, realise, but even though she was a long-standing Conservative cabinet minister and the foreign secretary, she was still something of an unknown entity with the public generally. And also on the issues, the Conservatives led Labour by 42 points to 27 on who was most trusted to grow the economy. And yet, fast forward to October, 67% dissatisfied with Liz Truss. The Conservative Party's fitness to govern falls from 46 points at the last general election to 16 points now. And Labour have a 13-point lead on managing the economy. And on that question of re-election, which I mentioned with Boris Johnson, 52% saying the Tories didn't deserve to be re-elected under him, that had fallen to 60%. So we can all throw out the 20-point poll leads, and I think for some, we might have even got as high as 30 with some of our competitors. But, I mean, it's worth looking at some of those underlying figures, I think, with some of this. Holly, what did you make of Liz Truss's time in office? I mean, that mini-budget seems to have just completely blown the Conservatives out of the water a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, similar thing to what you just said, to be honest, Kieran. I remember going to Labour Party conference with you, and that exact slide that you're talking about presenting, where we had a really long discussion at an event that we held about the jury still being out and how so many people, she's kind of an unknown entity, and people may be willing to give her a chance depending on what happened next. And I mean, we all know what happened next, and it all happened quite quickly. We were releasing data on a daily basis at that point then that was showing kind of record lows and highs in every which way as to how badly she had handled that situation, how badly the mini budget went down. Kwasi Kwarteng had kind of record low numbers as Chancellor of the Exchequer, and kind of the one data point we have on Liz Truss about whether or not she was doing a good job was rivaling John Major in the middle of the ERM crisis in the 1990s. So to go from a point where people were willing to give you a chance, or you were kind of a relative unknown, and obviously she won support amongst the membership in order to win that election, to then go on to last just 44 days and kind of be the, I mean, it's not the shortest serving prime minister in history. There are a couple from kind of the 1700s where terrible things happened, but in modern history, it's a pretty short tenure. And for your tenure as prime minister to be shorter than the actual the leadership contest that you run, I think speaks volumes in quite how damaging that mini budget was for her and her premiership.
But David, what do you think actually happened here? Because I mean, we all know the mini budget was a disaster, and all the economic fallout from that, and what that did to the government's reputation, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, how do you explain just how Truss and Kwarteng got it so badly wrong? I mean, because it just seems like such an own goal from the Conservative Party's perspective. There was this chance to reset. There was this chance to change leader and renew, so to speak. Obviously, it's gone completely the opposite direction. So what do you make of it?
I think one of the things, and of course, you're right, we can all focus on what happened with the financial markets and so on. But I think you can take a step back from that sort of the mini budget moment, if you like, and look at when Truss and Kwarteng first came into office. And there was just this feeling of, right, we're now going to completely clean out the stables. We're going to get rid of all these advisors. I mean, the most notable one being the permanent secretary at the Treasury, Tom Scholar, who was removed quite brutally by Kwarteng after they came into power. And, you know, there was just this sense of that anyone who disagrees with us, they're just going to be sort of removed from our path. We are going to do this. The orthodoxy is dead and we are going to challenge it. And they almost really, and I think what happened is they just sort of pumped each other up And they were sort of egging each other on, the Chancellor and the PM. And then I think, you know, people around them were sort of, even, you know, some in their camp were saying, well, actually, do you want to slow down here? And they were just thinking, no, we've got to get this done. She felt that she didn't have that much time to implement this, you know, complete reversal in economic approach, completely new policy, policy framework. And so I think that just meant that they wanted to go so fast that they weren't prepared to listen to any warnings about how dangerous that was going to be for the economy. So the minute the markets responded in the way that they did, and remember, the Bank of England had to step in. They didn't spend all this money, but it was £60 billion worth of sort of money to prop up the pension funds. Which were badly exposed. You know, when that happens, when that is a sort of self-inflicted wound, then really there's nowhere else to go.
And it's funny, when you look at, I always talk about the political parties as brands, and, you know, slightly simplistic, but there is an element of truth in it in terms of a characterization, is that Labour are seen as, you know, they're good on public services, they're well-meaning, they want to help the poor and ordinary people and that sort of thing, but can you trust them with the economy? Are they going to make tough decisions? Have they got the right leader that can be a prime minister? Whereas the Conservatives, almost the flip side, you know, well, they're not going to be in touch, we think they're probably a bit elitist and that sort of thing, but they can do the tough, you know, business of government and manage the economy. And honestly, the biggest problem the Conservatives have right now is it's that second bit that's been completely destroyed at the moment. And obviously, it's on Rishi Sunak to try and recover that. Let's hold that thought, though, on Rishi Sunak. We'll finish with that. I'll move the running order about a little bit, Holly, if that's OK. Let's talk a bit about Labour before we sort of finish on Sunak and the issues that are going forward. Presumably, Labour will feel very happy about 2022. I mean, they started the year 9 points ahead. They finish it 21 points ahead, although we've got one more Ipsos political monitor to come, so maybe it won't be that high, or maybe it'll be higher. We'll have to wait and see. But certainly a year of progress for Labour, would you say?
Yeah, I think they've got to be quite happy with the way 2022 has gone. And as you said, at the start of the year, we had them 9 points ahead. So we had Labour on 40% headline vote intention and the Conservatives on 31%, which by all accounts is quite a healthy lead. This was obviously against the backdrop of Partygate, the scandals that we've been discussing, and the damage to the brand of both the Conservative Party and Boris Johnson himself. And net satisfaction there for the government and for the Prime Minister at the time were falling off a cliff. And it wasn't, I think it's interesting that it wasn't that Labour necessarily were making too much noise or making too many moves themselves. They were kind of just sitting back and letting the Conservative Party do damage to themselves. And I think that's why we saw the lead that we did at the start of the year. You now fast forward to kind of the end of the year, and we've got Labour, as you said, Kieran, with our November poll, December yet to be released, 21 points ahead, which historically is a pretty staggering set of figures. And we saw plenty of records being broken in the polling stakes in the past couple of months. Labour hitting 50% with us at the moment on voting intention. And that rose particularly sharply in September, which coincided with Liz Truss becoming the Prime Minister. And it's pretty unprecedented territory, to be honest, for an opposition party, even who've been in opposition for this long, and not something that Labour have been used to. So it's kind of their highest ever recorded vote intention score that we've got. So it'd be interesting to see whether they're able to take advantage of that, given they've not been in this position before. And I think a lot of people are now looking at that lead and thinking it's possibly insurmountable, even 2 years out from a general election, if it's to be called at the point where it's going to come up.
We'll come to that the idea of whether the lead's insurmountable in a bit. But where do you stand, Holly, on this debate about, you know, has Starmer done anything, or has he just sort of been there and, you know, the musical chairs have stopped or whatever, and he's managed to catch the parcel, to mix metaphors at the right time? I mean, clearly we know the Conservatives have imploded, but has Starmer been able to do anything in your view?
Yeah, I think party image is really important. And over the past few years, the Labour brand has taken a bit of a beating in terms of the party image, also the leadership image as well. And Starmer's numbers haven't been outstanding over the past few years. I mean, we've had him floating around on kind of net zero, just negative figures throughout the year. I think the thing that they've managed to do this year is to be able to address what public priorities are, to be seen as competent on the sorts of things that are mattering for people at the moment. So we have Labour leading on every single measure we've polled in terms of public priorities, apart from growing the economy and the right decisions on foreign policy. And this includes double-digit leads on things like improving public services, reducing the cost of living, reducing waiting times in the NHS, offering a fresh start. So this is across different priorities. It's not just focused on one specific thing now. And I think them being able to take ownership of the economic agenda and prove or attempt to prove that they've got some sort of economic competence and steal that issue away from the Conservative parties, who historically have used that as their kind of mantle. I think going forwards, given the current political context and economic context, if Labour can continue to be proved to be strong on the economic side, they've got a chance. And we polled Rachel Reeves, in fact, even as a head on who would be the best chancellor against against Jeremy Hunt. And this is unprecedented as well. So we've not polled a Labour chancellor or a potential Labour chancellor being ahead of a Tory chancellor for over a decade or so. So I think that was a really important data point that we saw this year as well.
Yeah, I remember a couple of years ago, was it? I think it was Rishi Sunak was miles ahead of Annalise Dodds. And of course, this was during the pandemic when people say, well, that's when he was giving money away, etc. I understand all of that. But I remember at the time saying this is bad for Labour, and people would say, well, no one knows who the shadow chancellor is anyway, Kieran, and you know, you can't expect them to be ahead, etc. And maybe that was true at the time for those reasons, but it's a big change from where we are today. David, I'll come to you on Labour. A number that I'm a bit obsessed with is this idea of whether the Labour Party are ready for government. That's something that we track on our Ipsos Evening Standard political monitor. And in October, we had 47%. Saying that the Labour Party were ready for government. And that's the highest it's been since they've been in opposition by quite some way. It's the first time they've been in the 40s since 2010. And in fact, those numbers are essentially the same as David Cameron registered before either winning the 2010 election or certainly assuming office, whatever your semantic interpretation of that is. So clearly the public are starting to take Labour more seriously. It feels like, I mean, people say this shouldn't matter, but it feels like the lobby are taking Labour more seriously as well. Just the write-ups you get of Labour these days are of a party heading for government. Is that the vibe you get? Is it that Westminster is just starting to think, yeah, this is just where we're going now?
I mean, very much so. I mean, you have to. I mean, you know, if you're even if you're on the right of the political argument in terms of the press, you know, your likes of the Telegraph, the Mail, etc. Right, maybe not the Mail. The Mail are not going to get on board, but they are having to at least, as you say, treat them a bit more seriously and pay attention to what they're saying, because they know that this now is the most likely next government. So definitely there's been a shift. I think the moment where you could mark it was at the conference in September. You could it was really palpable just how much more confident everyone felt. You could see the suits were back. Everyone kept saying, oh, you know, business is here in a big way. And we saw it just last week with Labour doing a big sort of conference and meeting with business leaders. So you and look at the donations that are now going into the Labour Party compared to the Conservatives. So there is a feeling that the tectonic plates have shifted already. And, you know, it might be a couple of years from the election, and who knows what can happen in a couple of years. But it feels like that is now the direction of travel. So, of course, all of the lobby are having to treat them seriously. To go back to something Holly said about image, I think you can look at the Starmer project in sort of three stages. So the first stage was about putting as much distance between his Labour Party and the Labour Party of Jeremy Corbyn. And you saw that sort of most played out through the whole dealing with the anti-Semitism issue. So I think that was his first job, just to basically say, look, I'm here and I'm not Jeremy Corbyn. The second part has been very much in then positioning Labour to the centre. And so, you know, if you go back earlier this year, suddenly appearing in front of union flags in speeches and in any televised sort of addresses or anything like that, where shadow cabinet members were also doing the same. There was this sort of reconnecting with the patriotic working person and this sense of economic responsibility that they will treat, you know, they will look after working people, but ultimately they will be responsible with the economy. And they've been hammering that message as well. But obviously, as we now head into this period of discontent, you know, with strikes, Labour are still in a very uncomfortable position about that. And it's not, you know, it's not completely plain sailing for Starmer and for Labour, I don't think, on some of these issues. Immigration is another one. Brexit is another one, you know, where they still have not quite constructed the policy. So the third part of the programme, which he's got to do, is kind of really fleshing out those policy, those, you know, all right, you're a government in waiting. What exactly are you going to say about this, that or the other? And I think we're seeing a bit of it. So at conference, you know, this idea of a national green energy company, very interesting, you know, a sense of something different there. But I still think the jury is out and people, you know, are now listening. And I think they've got to try and communicate that a bit more.
Let's finish on Richard Sunak, the current Prime Minister. Obviously, an incredibly difficult challenge he's got given everything that's gone this year, although at the same time, a challenge that he will welcome, given that it looked like his political career was over in September, and it's funny how things change. I'm just going to throw out some numbers on the issues and where the Tory brand is, and maybe we can finish a little bit by where his priorities will lie. So on the issues, it's incredible to realise that at the start of the year, as I think I said earlier, the pandemic was number one in January on the Ipsos Issues Index as the top issue the public thought was facing the country. Now it's split between the economy on 45% and rising prices and inflation on 45%. And then there's a second tier of issues. So what about around one in five? So we do have a step change down, say the NHS, a lack of faith in politicians. And also immigration. So they're the kind of second order issues. Although, as I think we might come to, for conservative voters, immigration is very much not a second order issue. It's up there with the economy and cost of living. So there's a slightly complex dynamic there if you're the conservative seeking re-election, I suppose. And then the environment's slightly behind those on 16%, but margin of error being what it is, it's kind of in that second order of issues too. And then everything else is about one in 10. At the end, for the benefit of the viewer and listener, that's not me saying housing is unimportant or education is unimportant or anything like that. This is just what people spontaneously mention in polls as the most important issues. So, again, not saying those issues don't matter. And on the cost of living, I mean, it's rare that you sort of think you've seen it all to some extent, if that isn't too pious in polling. But some of the numbers we were producing with Sky earlier in the summer on the cost of living really were striking to me. We had one in three saying that they'd found it difficult to pay their bills in the previous 3 months, which, OK, you might think that's not a huge number, but it's a massive number when you think of the population as a whole. And whilst a lot of people are cutting back on going out, socialising, you know, maybe shopping around for cheaper brands and that sort of thing, you've got significant numbers of people that are skipping meals, getting into debt, really fearful for the future. I think anyone that's sort of seen vox pops on the broadcast or radio media will have seen that. So clearly a year where the economy and cost of living have become really important issues, amongst other things, as I've mentioned, but also a year where the Conservative Party brand, frankly, has tanked. So 6 in 10 say they don't have confidence in the Tories on improving the economy. 3/4 say they don't have confidence in the Tories on the cost of living or improving public services. So whilst I've got a piece, if I can plug it, in the Independent today, saying that, you know, whilst Rishi Sunak's personal poll ratings are not great, but they're not terrible. The Conservative Party brand seems in an awful lot of trouble. So maybe I'll come to you, David, first, and then go to Holly. I mean, where does Rishi Sunak start? I mean, a lot of people, when you throw out some of those numbers, it is easy to sort of fall into the trap of thinking, well, he's just got a couple of years, he gets to be Prime Minister, and then it's sort of see you later. But he's obviously going to give it a go, isn't he? So what do you think what are his priorities here?
Well, their big gamble or their big hope is that they can see they can weather 2023, which will be grim in economic terms, but that come the spring of 2024, in the run-up to an election, they might have just turned the corner and they'll be able to point to green shoots of recovery in the economy. It's by no means certain, of course, that that will happen, but you have to imagine that inflation will come off next year a bit in terms of the rate. It's at 11% now, but, you know, is forecast to fall, to be falling by the back end of next year. The interest rates may have peaked. You know, we're going to get a very, very bumpy ride in the new year. We don't know where the Bank of England base rate is going to stabilise. It'll, you know, probably 4%, something like that. A lot of mortgage holders will be in a lot of pain. And so there's still a lot of risk. But again, if they can sort of, if it peaks out in 2023 and is on the downward curve by 2024, then, you know, that is what they hope, that they can at least limit the damage to the Conservative brand for the future. And who knows, you know, maybe give Keir Starmer a closer run for his money than we currently think. So that's the sort of strategy, not very ambitious, but when you think about the sort of the wreckage that he had to sort of take on when he took over from Liz Truss, and all he can do really is just keep hammering that sort of message: calm, stable, I'm going to repair the finances, and at the same time try and deliver on some of those issues which really, really, you know, sort of aggravate the Tory right. So immigration and Brexit, if he can sort of deliver on those as well, then he can sort of stabilize his own position. And sort of, but it's a lot, you know, that is a lot of possibilities that can go wrong. And, you know, the general sense of resignation around the Conservative Party, you speak to any Tory MP, you know, they sort of think the die is cast, it's only a matter of time. Others are sort of already thinking about what they do after politics and so on. There is just a sense of end of days about all this.
Yeah, and a lot of them, Sajid Javid maybe being the highest profile off the top of my head, but a lot of Conservatives deciding they're not standing again. I mean, Holly, what do you make of it? I mean, I suppose in some ways, whilst Rishi Sunak's personal poll ratings aren't spectacular, when you ask who would make the most capable prime minister, he does lead Keir Starmer by, I think, it was 6 points off the top of my head in our last political monitor. So, I mean, maybe he's got... One option is to try and presidentialise the next election and make it about Sunak versus Starmer, and hoping that the Tory brand can take some of this this Sunak gloss, if that's the right phrase, and that's one of the ways he fights back. I mean, what do you make of it all?
It's probably worth a shout, to be honest. I wouldn't rule any options off the table. I think, as we've mentioned, the problem currently is the economy's been top of our issues index many, many times over the years. Those macro level economic issues start to hit people on a household level and an individual level, and that's what we've seen. That's what we've seen this year. They're turning into the cost of living crisis. People feeling the pinch in their personal lives. Our financial well-being tracker released a couple of weeks back shows 6 in 10 are currently concerned about their financial situation. I don't see that improving anytime soon, and that's against a backdrop of people telling us things like their food shopping prices have increased, utilities, bills, fuel. It's beyond a double and triple whammy at this point. It's every single element of people's lives are being affected by the economic outlook. And the outlook here generally as well isn't particularly optimistic. So our economic optimism index latest showed a net score of minus 56. And that's consistently throughout this year some of the lowest levels that we've seen since the 2008 financial crash. So not great company to be in terms of historic lows. I think, as you said, Rishi Sunak's got a chance on kind of some places where he stands out compared to Keir Starmer. So in terms of leadership image, Sunak polls better on things like attention to detail, although they're both pretty high scorers on that. Good in a crisis is a really interesting one. So Rishi Sunak leads Keir Starmer by 14 points on that. I think that's unsurprising, given the fact, I suppose, he's been tested in a crisis as Chancellor throughout the coronavirus pandemic. But it does give him something to work with, that the public are seeing him as someone who can potentially get us out of this sort of situation, although it's a very different situation doing it as Prime Minister than it was as Chancellor. And again, on personality as well, he leads. So there are a few kind of personal points where he's leading Keir Starmer that he could attempt to take advantage of in an attempt to almost distract from the situation that's going on contextually. But he still struggles on things like being in touch with the people, being honest, I think is a really tricky for him to be down on compared to Starmer, and also sharing the values of ordinary people. So there are a few things that he possibly needs to work on to be able to convince people that he is the man to be able to take people out of this crisis through the next election, and to make things kind of tangibly and palpably better for people on the ground. And I think that's where we see the economic blame of not just the past kind of few months, but our polling is telling us that people are now bringing up things from the past 12 years of Tory government and beginning to set the blame by the door of Rishi Sunak for that.
Well, yes, certainly a daunting intro for the Prime Minister. But if there's one thing we know in politics over the last sort of 5-10 years, it's expect the unexpected. So Lord knows what will happen with Ukraine and the cost of living and other unexpected issues that we don't know about yet. The unknown unknowns. So we will be here to measure it. To finish with something a bit lighter, Holly, we have our annual Ipsos Santa's Naughty and Nice list. Do you want to tell the viewers and listeners a bit about that and some of the findings?
We do indeed, and Rishi Sunak might feel a bit more positive about this one, and you'll figure that out as I go through the list of people that have appeared. But what we've done is we've polled a list of around 40 public figures, including some celebrities, political figures, and asked then who they'd expect to be on Santa's Naughty and Nice list. And I thought we should start with the Naughty list so we can finish on a high with the Nice list, if you're both okay with that. Yeah. So the top of our Naughty list sees Vladimir Putin coming out on top with 60% of the vote. I don't think too many surprises there. He's followed by last year's number one, Donald Trump, in second place. And then we've got Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock in joint third place. Liz Truss in fourth and Kanye West bringing up the rear in fifth place. So that's a bit of a weird combination of people. But what are we making of this year's top five?
Do you want to go first, David?
Well, I'm just trying to work out priorities here. I mean, obviously Putin, but how is it that Liz Truss, can, after everything that happened, can be below Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock? That's quite an interesting finding. What was Liz Truss's percentage, out of interest?
Liz Truss's percentage was 41%.
And still quite high, I suppose.
The first thing I want to make clear is I struggled with this list. Calling Vladimir Putin naughty for invading Ukraine does sound somewhat flippant, but I want to stress that he was on the list the last 2 years. So to take him off the list completely looked a little bit loaded as well. So it was a little bit of a catch-22 as to what you do with it. But I think it does reflect just how unpopular he is in Britain. Kanye West being in the news recently, of course. So I suppose that, but lots of Tories on there, David, aren't there?
There are, and I think that again goes back to what we've been talking about in terms of the collapse in confidence and the collapse in popularity of the Conservative Party. Yeah, as you say, but Matt Hancock, obviously, I mean, he hasn't really been that prominent this year in terms of his politics, has he? I mean, he's obviously been prominent with his trip to the jungle. So I don't know whether the question was asked just around the time that Matt Hancock perhaps went into the jungle. He was incredibly unpopular with his own Tory colleagues, that's for sure. But no, it's interesting that he features quite so highly.
Yeah, it was a week or so ago, so it would have been in people's minds. I haven't got the figures in front of me, but one of the things I did find quite funny was that when we asked favourability towards Matt Hancock after his jungle exploits, it hadn't moved at all since he resigned, since just after he resigned. It was a good majority. It was a low 50s majority saying they were unfavourable towards him. Hadn't moved at all. So I did laugh. I don't want to name check anybody in a negative way because I'm not like that. But there was somebody that wrote an article that said, "Oh, Matt Hancock in I'm a Celebrity shows how the Tories win the next general election." And I thought that's a little bit of a stretch, given that, you know, yes, he did quite well in the public vote, but we're not talking about that many people that ring up and actually text and vote on these things. My mum watches all of the reality TV stuff religiously. She won't mind me saying, hopefully. Doubt she watches anyway. But I always say to her, "Do you vote, mum, in this? Do you text in or do you call?" "Oh, God, no, I don't do that. I just watch it." So I'm not sure the fact that he finished third or whatever necessarily means anything for his wider public reputation.
And of course, a lot of the people that were probably ringing up to make sure that he continued to face these challenges were the other 640 odd members of the Conservative Party, probably quite keen to see him keep eating various parts of animals and so on. But
yeah,
I've also got a late entry I'd like to throw into the naughty list, which obviously couldn't be polled because it only happened on Saturday. But the referee from the England-France match, I think, would probably feature somewhere in the top in the top five if we sent that out off the back of this weekend.
Well, as a just to break up the political England dominance. Fan, I'm as a Spurs supporting England fan, I'm blocking that out of my memory. Holly, not a good day at the office, that one.
just to break up the political dominance of the naughty list that we tend to see on an annual basis.
The nice list is less political though, right?
It is indeed, yeah. So onto the nice list, the top spot goes to NHS workers with 50% of the vote. They're still pretty high up there from last year. Then in joint second, we've got the dynamic duo of David Attenborough and Paddington Bear, which is quite the combination. Followed up closely in third place by Martin Lewis, the Lionesses, so the European winning England ladies football team in fourth, and the Ukrainian president Zelensky bringing up the rear in fifth place there. So a much more eclectic list on the nice side compared to the naughty side, I think. Any surprises in there for you two?
Well, the NHS workers know that's the third year in a row they've been top. And I think what it shows is even in the absence of the pandemic, which was a very specific crisis that quite rightly NHS workers were revered over how they handled that. The NHS is still, obviously, as we know, something that's really important to people and that they have a lot of pride in. So I'm not surprised. And obviously, it's also a group of people. And look, these polls are a bit of fun when we do this at Christmas. You know, you could query it and say, oh, that's not an individual, that's a group of people, etc. Same with the Lionesses. But, you know, we're just taking a temperature here of what the public think. The one that I have to say, David Attenborough regularly polls very, very well. And you know, I'm not surprised by that in the sense of I knew he was well liked and well loved in the British public's eyes, but it always strikes me just how much. Paddington Bear's a funny one because I'm not quite sure what he did. I mean, a lot of the cartoons look like he was some sort of royal grim reaper leading the Queen off to heaven or something. It was all a bit odd, but yes, people like Paddington, don't they? What do you reckon, David?
Well, I'm just curious to ask, like, was the Queen on the list? Because obviously the public, huge public affection. Right, okay, Paddington was a proxy vote for the Queen.
Yes.
Maybe that's what people were expressing.
She'd always been in the top five on the nice list in a way that King Charles isn't.
That's interesting.
I can't remember where exactly he was. I think he was seventh or eighth on the list or something. He wasn't negative, but it kind of will be interesting, I suppose, long term. Obviously, lots of public sympathy for him at the moment. But
I think the striking one there for me was Martin Lewis, because again, it speaks to the kind of priorities of people as we come towards the end of the year and look ahead to next year. You know, Martin Lewis has really carved out this amazing reputation for himself. You know, it's now being spoken to by political leaders. You know, what does Martin Lewis think? And quite rightly, you know, he has got that sort of sense of, you know, providing really, really good information for people who are really worried about cost of living and how their bills are going up and how to make those better. But just really, really speaks to the times, doesn't it? When you've got a money-saving expert in that top five there in terms of the nice list, I think that really speaks volumes for me.
And if people want to see where others on our list figure, there we've got Colleen Rooney, Rebecca Vardy, I think Beckham might be in there. But we've got Piers Morgan, God, Dan, tweet that one out. And lots of other people, you can see where they are on our website when we publish the results, which I think they will be published by the time this goes out. That's all we've got time for this week's podcast episode. Nice note to end on there. Big thanks to my guests David Bond and Holly Day. I hope you have enjoyed listening and watching, and if you like what you see, do subscribe, like, share wherever you get your podcasts from, and happy Christmas.